Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, we're lucky to have with us Matt Haig, author of his latest novel, How to Stop Time, published in February by Viking. Matt is the author of the best-selling memoir, Reasons to Stay Alive, along with novels including The Humans and The Radleys, as well as several award-winning children's books. He's also lucky enough that Benedict Cumberbatch picked up his book before it was even finished, signed on to star and produce the film version of this book, and it's being screenwritten by a couple of great screenwriters. How to Stay Alive is a book about immortality, or as close to immortality as one can get. Tom Hazard has been alive for centuries, but he only looks like he's in his early 40s thanks to a genetic reconfiguration, mutation, what you will, that for better or worse causes him to age very, very slowly. The novel travels, as Tom does as well, since he has all the time in the world, from Elizabethan England, where we fall in love with the works of Shakespeare, and actually meet Shakespeare for a few pages, to Jazz Age, Lost Generation Paris, where we converse with the Fitzgeralds, to New York, to the South Seas, to Australia. Tom is forced to avoid suspicion of all kinds, you know, people saying that he never ages, to move every 8 years or so to avoid detection, you know, as the folks around him get older and wrinkly and he stays the same as he was outwardly. However, you don't really leave the past behind, no matter how long you live. And one of the hardest things Tom has to learn, imperfectly, is to never fall in love, because love transcends time. It could really screw up an immortal's life. So, but Tom wants an ordinary life. But the question is, can he have one? And that's what we'll find out. Welcome, Matt, and thanks so much for joining us today.
It's nice to be here. Nice to talk to you, Sam.
So what is it about living forever that so intrigues us?
I think for me personally, writing the book, one of the things I wanted to explore was how it might not be all that it's cracked up to be. I think for me, I'm someone who's quite a neurotic, hypochondriacal kind of person, and I think it's quite therapeutic for me to imagine living for a very, very, very long time and actually seeing that that might be problematic, and there might be something quite comforting about the sort of normal human length of life, and that was the sort of interesting thing that I wanted to explore.
So yeah, you've been very open about depression and anxiety and hypochondria. You sound just exactly like me. but so you feel like this was somewhat purgative? It actually was therapeutic to you to write this book?
Yeah, absolutely. And also in the sense that he's a character who's known a lot of grief, a lot of depression, a lot of pain in his life, a lot of darkness. But actually to try and find within that bleakness, some sort of light, some kind of hope. Because I always think that something's much more comfort and value if it's optimistic, but it's optimistic from a place of, pain or real emotion and darkness. You know, there's nothing more depressing when you're depressed than reading a story about everyone being happy and everything being perfect. So I like to sort of explore someone having a kind of crisis in their life, or he's had lots of crises in his very long life, and to then find the sort of spark of hope inside it.
Yeah, there's a lot of immortality-type books that have a depressive type of edge to them. And, you know, you've kind of genre-busted things with this book. It has a bit of fantasy, romance, somewhat of a comedy, an adventure story, a thriller. Did you intend to do that, or you just like writing outside the box, so to speak?
Yeah, I do. I like writing outside the box. I think it's not something I consciously think about, but I suppose I find I know why genres exist, and I know why genre labels exist, and it can be very useful in some ways. I think creatively they can become a bit of a handicap. You know, if you start to see yourself, say, as a science fiction writer or a historical fiction writer or a romance writer, I think there's a risk that you get boxed in, and you know, story, what you're doing essentially with a novel is you're telling a story. And I'm sure when people started telling stories, I mean, if you go back to, I don't know, the Greek myths, for instance, they contained everything. They had elements of fantasy, they had elements of philosophy, they had elements of history, and it all blend in. Same with Shakespeare, who actually makes this sort of cameo appearance in the book. You know, it all messed together. And somewhere along the line, whether it's to do with marketing or modernism or whatever, we've decided to compartmentalize books into their own separate categories. And I think it's much more fun when you mix things up and mash things together.
You do bring a lot of familiar faces into the pages, including the Fitzgeralds, for example. But then you also bring some contemporary people in, like Philip K. Dick, the book Flowers for Algernon, even Billie Jean by Michael Jackson, and then even Donald Trump, which goes along with your 666-word Facebook entry, which has gone viral. So what made you do that?
Well, I wanted, you know, I wanted to write a book that was essentially about history, but from the perspective of the present. For me, when I'm reading a historical novel, sometimes, however well written it is, sometimes it seems very sealed off and shut in the past. I thought it'd be very interesting to take this book as a something that was very much set firmly in this age of Twitter, of Trump, of the internet, of social media, and be also about the past. And I think one of the dangerous things about the age we're living in politically and socially is there's a lot of history forgetting. There's a lot of not understanding the links between things and why things happen and learning the mistakes of the past. And so I thought, you know, this was the perfect time to write this book. And also I was writing it, I wrote a bulk of this book back in 2016, when obviously both your country was having a lot of political change, my country in terms of voting for Brexit and all of that campaign happening, it was all underway. And there's this very great sense of, like, we're entering this new sort of phase of history, a slightly darker phase and a more divisive phase in lots of ways. And, you know, so that was just seeping into the book as I was writing it. It wasn't necessarily a conscious thing, but it was just there. It was in the zeitgeist.
It's funny, when we were talking earlier about why people are so fascinated, there was an article in the Washington Post on January 23rd that included your book and four others that dealt with immortality. In fact,
yeah.
I'll be interviewing Thomas Pierce about the afterlives in a couple of minutes, I think. So it's all of a sudden seems like it's just everybody is interested and drawn to it. Do you think the fear of death, the idea of gaining wisdom, you did talk about it a little.
I don't know. It coincides, I think, with actual real attempts. I mean, you might have heard of this, but like in Silicon Valley and all these biotech firms who are actually trying to make us immortal and trying to sort of reverse the aging process in really sort of serious ways at the sort of molecular level with nanotechnology and stuff.
Yeah, like Peter Thiel and Jeff Bezos.
It's a very attractive idea, but it's also a very sort of dystopian idea, especially the fact that when this technology and when this ability first emerges, if it ever does, it will be available only to a sort of certain select few of society, the super rich and what have you. So it presents an idea of an even more equal world. So I think we're at this point where we're looking at the human lifespan in a different way and mortality in a different way. But again, that poses its own challenges. I mean, very few of us would actually opt for a shorter length of life, but at the same time, if we all started living for hundreds of years, then there'd be not only be a population crisis, there'd be all sorts of ethical crises and different dilemmas that would be arise up with that. So that was all interesting to explore.
Yeah, I was reading the other article, was the one in the New York Times about what you were just talking about. You're right, rich white men like Peter Thiel and Jeff Bezos are just talking about the caps on the end of our telerooms and how to extend those. So yeah, you just and then I guess you must be really excited about the fact that out of all these books, Benedict Cumberbatch picked it up and decided he wanted to create a movie and be both the star and the director. How did that happen?
Well, that was totally surreal. I mean, not least because of when it happened. It happened while I was still writing the book. I'd finished the second draft. My publisher must have sort of cheekily sort of sent him a copy at some point. I think he'd had some contact with him in the past, but anyway, he got to read it, and they made an offer before I'd even finished the book, which was, well, it was obviously great and wonderful and dream come true and all of that, but it was quite a strange thing to then go back into the book and knowing who was going to be playing the central character and trying not to get too influenced by that, trying not to say, oh, he looks a little bit like Sherlock Holmes. And quite intense brooding stare. And that was a very surreal process, but it was good for my confidence at that sort of neurotic point where you're editing a book. I hate editing. It's my worst thing, going back over, because basically your editor just gives you a list of everything wrong with your book, basically, and you're going through, and I hate that process. So to have that bit of amazing good news at that point was lovely.
Yeah, I can imagine. You must have been over the moon. I mean, you're a very popular author and very prolific, but to have someone pick it up in the middle of the process, yeah, definitely unusual.
Yeah, no, totally. And it certainly never happened to me before. And the fact that it was him as well, and the fact that he wanted to play the central character, it means it's more likely that other things can happen. They've already got a great screenwriter for it, Anthony McCartan, who wrote the Churchill film that's out at the moment, Darkest Hour.
Yeah.
He also did the Stephen Hawking film, Theory of Everything. So they've got a lot of great talent for it. I don't think they want me massively involved with the project, but that suits me fine. I was responsible for the book. I'll leave the experts to the film side.
So even though it's your son, you're more than willing to let it go out into the world.
Yeah, because I don't know about you, but if I see a film adaptation of a book, and I say, worst case scenario, I'm not enjoying the film adaptation of the book, it doesn't necessarily diminish the book in my mind. The book is its own kind of entity, and I think that's all you can be responsible for. Also, for my own sanity, if I start sort of sitting daydreaming about red carpets, films happening and premieres, you go a bit insane. So if I was actually working on the screenplay, I that's all I'd be thinking about all the time, the film happening. And I think for my sanity, it's better just to get on with other stories and other books.
The last question, because I know you're limited for time. What made you be so interested in Montaigne's essays and also with the musical instrument, the lute?
Originally the whole story was going to be much more about the musical element. It was going to be like, he was going to be like the historical version of, I don't know, say Prince or someone, and played like 100 different instruments, and it was all going to be about music. Lute, I think when I started writing it, me and my son were starting to learn the guitar together. Like, my son is very young, he was 9 at the time, but we bought him a guitar. And so I was just getting into, because obviously the guitar progressed. Originally, the Elizabethan version of the guitar was the lute. And I was fascinated in that because I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know anything about lute music except a little bit of Shakespeare and stuff. But, when I was researching it and some of the old songs they used to play on the lute, that was sort of like the rock songs of the day, there was a guy called John Marland, I think, or Roland, who was the popular songwriter of the day, and lots of his songs were sort of controversial. And the parallels, we like to think pop music was invented in the 1950s, but, it's been forever, pop music. And, the love songs of the 1580s often had sort of risque lyrics, as they might do today. And so that was just interesting in terms of the historical parallels. Montaigne was just someone I mainly knew from quotations. I sort of knew his quotations. I'd never really studied him at university or anything. But then I started sort of reading him a little bit more deeply. And he was someone who was a philosopher, obviously, and he had a sort of amazing and quite sort of decadent life himself, and was a kind of a political figure as well. And I realized the more I read of him, a lot of the other sort of thinkers that I read a lot of, whether it's Hazlitt or Nietzsche or Rousseau, they were all very inspired by Montaigne. So he's one of those writers that's more of an inspiration than we realize, just because he inspired so many of the great thinkers.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a fascinating book. I own an independent bookstore, so it's on the front table, and I hope to talk to you again. And great
luck.
Yeah,
lovely. Where's your bookstore, by the way?
It's just in just outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in the States. So, yeah.
Oh, perfect. I'll look it up. Brilliant.
Okay. Okay, yeah, we have a website. It's Wellington Square Books.
I will do. Okay, I'll look at that.
All right.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. So we were speaking with Matt Haig, who wrote How to Stop Time, just published in February by Viking. great book. It's a book about immortality. And like I said, in Washington Post just had an article about five books that deal with immortality. And Matt's was one of them. And the cool thing about Matt's book is it's already been picked up. Benedict Cumberbatch, who everybody loves, Doctor Strange and all that stuff, he's going to star in it. And it's the perfect role for him. This guy who travels through times from Elizabethan England all the way to modern times. And he is a fantastic musician. He plays 30 instruments. That's a big part of the book. And also, we get to meet people we know. Like, he hangs out with Shakespeare. He hangs out with F. Scott Fitzgerald and his wife, Zelda. He gets to meet all kinds of people, which you would if you lived. He lives 15 times slower than a normal human being. It's like the opposite of progeria. In any event, I really enjoy talking to him. And I'm going to be talking... the gentleman who wrote The Afterlives, which is another one of the books that was on the immortality list, Thomas Pierce. And I look forward to that and the juxtaposition between that book and Matt's book. So in any event, thanks so much for joining us today. And we look forward to seeing you here again, or having you here again, on The Avid Reader.